Holland, we have the worst homes that pay the highest rent. High overhead. We are forced to take in roomers in order to help us pay our rent. Y'all experience that every day. You rent one of these old rundown apartments here in Holland, but from the white man. And he charges you so much rent for that apartment, you got to rent part of it out in order to get some of your money back. So what happens? Our apartments become filled with relatives, with strangers. Our community becomes overcrowded. And these overcrowded conditions under which our people are forced to live eliminates all chance for a normal home, for a clean home, or for a healthy home.
Now with this bill, the voice of justice speaks again. It proclaims that fair housing for all human beings who live in this country is now a part of the American way of life.
Because my friends, let this message come through clear from what I say tonight. Time is running out for the merchants of crime and corruption in American society. The wave of crime is not going to be the wave of the future in the United States of America.
Why is there no real affordable housing in the United States? Why is this a perennial problem that has never been solved? Because there's no money in creating affordable housing for poor and working class people. There's no money to be made. So that when that is left to the private sector to fulfill, you know, it always comes up short because there's no money to be made in housing those kinds of people.
In the US today, the number of households who are renting is near post-war highs. Since the 2008 recession, home ownership has dropped by 6%. While 17% of households pay over half their income in rent, another fifth pay over a third. According to the standard measures of affordability, there is no US state where a full-time minimum wage worker can afford to rent or own a one-bedroom dwelling. This crisis has been further exposed during the current coronavirus pandemic. With record rates of unemployment and 30 million workers collecting jobless benefits, the tenuous precarity of America's housing market is on full display. In April, almost 1 in 3 Americans did not pay their rent. Now, with federal unemployment insurance set to expire at the end of July, and eviction bans lifting across the country, some experts believe between 20 million and 28 million people could face eviction between now and September. But how did we get to this point? In the first part of our two-part documentary podcast on the US housing crisis, we dig deeper into the history of US housing policy and place the negligence of Trump's tenure in the context of decades of disinvestment and privatization by successive administrations.
At the very same time that America refused to give the Negro any land, through an act of Congress, our government was giving away millions of acres of land in the West and the Midwest, which meant that it was willing to undergird its white peasants from Europe with an economic floor. But not only did they give the land, they built land-grant colleges with government money to teach them how to farm. Not only that, they provided county agents to further their expertise in farming. Not only that, they provided low interest rates in order that they could mechanize their farms. Not only that, today many of these people are receiving millions of dollars in federal subsidies not to farm, and they are the very people telling the black man that he ought to lift himself by his own bootstraps. Now, this is what we are faced with, and this is the reality. Now, when we come to Washington in this campaign, we are coming to get our check.
A history of the politics of land and housing, reveals the racism and inequality that has been at the foundation of American society since its inception. Following the Civil War, General Sherman announced Field Order No. 15, which declared that freed slaves would be allocated 40 acres and a mule in former Confederate land along the Southwest. However, Andrew Johnson, President Abraham Lincoln's successor, following his assassination in 1865, annulled the order to appease the Southern states. As a result, freed slaves went from being property to workers living in desperate poverty. Having been denied education and wages, many newly freed people were forced to rent land from their former white owners. Known as sharecroppers, they were obligated to pay rent on the land by giving a portion of their crop to the landowner. This compulsion to wage labor essentially eliminated the possibility of land ownership for freed slaves. Following the period of Reconstruction, racial exploitation took on a new form, imposed not only by explicit force, but by economic dependence. Following decades of terror, discrimination, and destitution, large numbers of black families migrated to northern cities in a period that became known as the Great Migration. Between 1915 and 1930, over 6 million black people relocated from the South to the North. In cities such as Detroit, New York, and Philadelphia, the black population more than tripled. In 1929, the stock market crashed, launching the U.S. into the Great Depression. Millions of Americans lost their housing. Mass unemployment forced millions around the country onto breadlines, and in the thriving black community of Harlem, New York, joblessness reached over 50%.
Only a few years ago, we were a discouraged people because we were the first to lose our jobs when Old Man Depression came along and the last to get them back. We struggled vainly to regain our bearings while depression, fear, and failure stalked the nation. A tenth of the population of the United States, we formed as a race over a sixth of the unemployed. One out of every four of us was on relief. In vain, we sought for something to restore our confidence, our hope, our courage. Without jobs, we had no money. And without money, we could not purchase food for the hungry mouths at home. Our only hope lay in charity.
During the Great Depression, the mortgage industry collapsed. By 1934, 50% of urban mortgages were delinquent. The severe housing crisis saw thousands evicted from their homes and forced onto the streets. More than 2 million people became homeless. Shanty towns were erected throughout urban centers, often called Hoovervilles, named after the incumbent president, Herbert Hoover. In New York, the largest Hooverville was located in the middle of Central Park. With feebly built shacks and unsanitary living conditions, these shanty towns were often deemed illegal and raided by state and federal authorities.
The 1928 was a good building year. Almost $3 billion worth of new residential construction saw the light of day. But in 1929, even before the Depression became general, building dropped off to slightly under $2 billion. Year after year, throughout the Depression, this decline continued, each succeeding drop meaning thousands more men laid off in the building and allied industries. Until in 1934, all of the new homes built in the United States were worth only $227 million. A decline of 92% from 1928. But due to the stimulation of the National Housing Act, 1935 presents a different picture. From every section of the country come reports of vastly increased building activity.
Prior to the New Deal, the US government had no official housing policies at the federal level. Following the stock market crash and the subsequent housing crisis, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt passed the National Housing Act of 1934 as part of his New Deal regeneration plan. This established the Federal Housing Administration, or FHA. Aimed at boosting the economy by expanding the number of homeowners, the 1934 Act stated that the federal government would insure mortgages across a range of newly built developments. The Homeowners Loan Corporation created residential security maps to assess the creditworthiness of certain neighborhoods. These marked the best areas in green, blue for good people, yellow for working class families, and red for, quote, detrimental influences. These red zones invariably included areas with significant minority populations. In practice, segregation became an FHA policy, deeming black neighborhoods as risky and thus denying them access to government-backed mortgages. This became known as redlining. The last major piece of housing legislation during the New Deal period was the 1937 Wagner-Stegall Act. This provided federal subsidies for local agencies to eliminate slums and build affordable housing units. It also created the USHA, US Housing Authority, which dispersed rental subsidies to private landlords on behalf of low-income households through Section 8 of the Act. Between September 1937 and June 1941, the USHA lent about $800 million towards the construction of 587 low-rent developments. As these funds were distributed via local authorities, racial segregation was further propagated by entrenched redlining.
There were a group of congressmen with long memories who were in the last war. They knew that when a man gets out of the Army or Navy or Marines, he's worried most about a job, an education, and a home. And that's why Congress, led by the President, passed the law. The Servicemen's Readjustment Act of 1944, better known as the GI Bill of Rights. And to make sure it works, a Veterans Administration is already busy in Washington with General Frank Hines in charge.
Sounds all right. Sounds great, in fact. But I'm from Missouri. You got to show me, brother.
Happy to. Nice house, isn't it?
Sure, it's nice. And if I'm lucky, after I get out, in 5 or 10 years, I'll have one pretty much like it.
Well, George Tobin, just driving in, didn't have to wait any 5 or 10 years. As soon as he got out of the Navy, he applied to the Director of Finance, Veterans Administration in Washington. And they were able to help him get a loan by guaranteeing it up to $2,000. Of course, George, like every veteran, had to meet certain conditions, prove he was a reliable citizen. But he was able to do that all right.
I guess I was all wrong about it being like last time. But wait a second. What about the beautiful blonde? Don't tell me the GI Bill of Rights guarantees every returning serviceman one of those, too.
No, that's still up to the veteran. Just as it's up to him to take advantage of the GI Bill of Rights and not expect the government to come after him. The GI Bill of Rights is not a reward or a handout or a gravy train, but rather an American way to make it easier for each man to take his place once again in the community and get some of those things for which he went to war. A job, a business, an education, a home.
Following the Second World War, returning veterans were granted a range of benefits from the 1944 Servicemen's Readjustment Act, commonly referred to as the GI Bill. By 1955, the GI program had granted guaranteed mortgages to 4.3 million homes. Once again, however, the administration of this program displayed deep-set racial discrimination. Mortgages were not administered by the Veterans Administration, but rather by financial institutions, whose redlining excluded the nearly 1.2 million black people returning from the war. Many GI mortgages were guaranteed in newly established suburbs outside of metropolitan centers, home to predominantly all-white populations. These communities had strict racist covenants, maintaining racial homogeneity by preventing the sale of private homes to minority buyers. In 1947 Mississippi, for example, only 2 of 3,200 GI-backed mortgages in 13 cities went to black borrowers. In the suburbs of New York and New Jersey, fewer than 100 of the 67,000 mortgages insured by the GI Bill supported home purchases by non-whites. As federal and local policies excluded the development of black community wealth, America's post-war population became increasingly segregated. In a period known as white flight, many white residents fled to the suburbs. In contrast, black communities in urban centers were consistently targeted. Policies such as the Federal Aid Highway Act of 1944 subsidized interstate highway construction. Proposed by city planners such as Robert Moses, this policy devastated urban, largely black residential communities. Estimates suggest that highway construction displaced 475,000 families and over 1 million Americans, most of which were minority communities. The fallout from these post-war policies strikes at the heart of the racial wealth gap that plagues America today. By the conclusion of the original GI Bill in July 1956, nearly $33 billion had been disbursed. As white America amassed generational wealth and stability, black America was explicitly excluded from the post-war middle class.
Congress passes the most sweeping civil rights bill ever to be written into the law, and thus reaffirms the conception of equality for all men that began with Lincoln and the Civil War 100 years ago. The Negro won his freedom then. He wins his dignity now. 5 hours after the House passes the measure, the Civil Rights Act of 1964 is signed at the White House by President Johnson. Before an audience of legislators and civil rights leaders who had labored long and hard for passage of the bill, President Johnson calls for all Americans to back what he calls a turning point in history.
We must not approach the observance and enforcement of this law in a vengeful spirit. Its purpose is not to punish. Its purpose is not to divide, but to end divisions. Divisions which have lasted all too long. Its purpose is national, not regional. This Civil Rights Act is a challenge to all of us to go to work in our communities and our states, in our homes and in our hearts, to eliminate the last vestiges of injustice in our beloved country. So, tonight I urge every public official, every religious leader, every business and professional man, every working man, every housewife, I urge every American to join in this effort to bring justice and hope to all our people and to bring peace to our land.
There's warm applause from members of both parties as the president sets to work.
Despite the passage of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, which outlawed the segregation of public spaces, schools, and facilities, housing discrimination remained rampant.
Here in Harlem, we have the worst homes that pay the highest rent. High overhead. We are forced to take in roomers in order to help us pay our rent. Y'all experience that every day. You rent one of these old rundown apartments here in Harlem from the white man. He charges you so much rent for that apartment, you got to rent part of it out in order to get some of your money back. So what happens? Our apartments become filled with relatives, with strangers. Our community becomes overcrowded. And these overcrowded conditions under which our people are forced to live eliminates all chance for a normal home, for a clean home, or for a healthy home. Your home soon becomes filled with cockroaches and rats who live better than you do. And because our children are forced to grow up in this overcrowded atmosphere, the lack of much-needed privacy destroys their sense of shame. It lowers their moral standards and leaves them exposed to every form of indecency and vice that is running rampant in the community.
In 1965, Congress passed a Housing Act to establish a new department for Housing and Urban Development, or HUD. This largely symbolic move consolidated housing governance into one federal agency, with its own cabinet position, the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development. As the 60s continued, it became increasingly apparent that the legislative gains won by the civil rights movement were failing to significantly improve the material conditions of African Americans across the country. As Dr. Martin Luther King and the Poor People's Campaign grew in influence, the civil rights movement began to focus in particular on housing discrimination and affordability in northern cities. One of the early iterations of this shift was the Chicago Freedom Movement of 1966, led by the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and Dr. King, which highlighted the inadequate and segregated education, housing, and employment in the North.
By moving north and by concerning itself with equality in housing and employment, the civil rights movement began to encounter increased resistance, the so-called white backlash.
Well, this is a terrible thing. I've been in many demonstrations all across the South, but I can say that I have never seen, even in Mississippi and Alabama, mobs as hostile and as hate-filled as I've seen in Chicago.
But the march will go on anyway?
Oh, very definitely. We can't stop the march. We've been going on in a few minutes.
You feel you're in a closed society, Dr. King, here in the southwest side of Chicago?
Oh, yes. It's definitely a closed society, and we're going to make it an open society.
Just slide up a little bit.
And we feel that we have to do it this way in order to bring the evil out into the open so that this community will be forced to deal with it.
A central demand of the movement was for a ban on housing discrimination and the active promotion of black community wealth building. These demands reflected the desperation of poverty-stricken communities throughout urban centres, where living conditions had consistently deteriorated as a result of institutional neglect. In the summer of 1967, race riots sprung up in majority black cities such as Newark and Detroit, sparked in part by egregious acts of police brutality.
Newark, New Jersey became a city of race riots, violence, looting, and hate. For 5 days, it was a battleground and a looter's paradise. Colored citizens clashed with police, National Guardsmen, and state troopers. 24 people were killed and 1,200 injured. Nearly half the city was in the grip of terror. The Newark flare-ups sparked similar riots in other American centers, with hatred near danger point between white and black extremist groups. In Newark, there was an uneasy tension, punctuated by minor outbreaks of violence after 5 days of bloody fighting.
As many mainstream commentators dismissed the 1967 riots as sporadic flashpoints of looting and uncoordinated violence, the Johnson administration established the Kerner Commission to investigate the true cause of unrest. Returning in 1968, the commission's report cited a lack of economic opportunity, and in particular, poverty and substandard housing, as the key causes of the uprisings. To address the crisis of systemic poverty, Commissioner Chairman Otto Kerner stated, quote, "A commitment to national action, backed by the resources of the most powerful nation on earth, was needed."
This is our basic conclusion. Our nation is moving toward two societies, one black, one white, separate and unequal. Reaction to last summer's disorders has quickened the movement and deepened the division. Discrimination and segregation have long permeated much of American life. They now threaten the future of every American. To pursue our present course will involve the continuing polarization of the American community and ultimately the destruction of basic democratic values. The alternative will require a commitment to national action, compassionate, massive, and sustained, backed by the resources of the most powerful and richest nation on the earth. From every American, it will require new attitudes, new understanding, and above all, new will.
Following Dr. King's public assassination in Memphis in April 1968, President Lyndon Johnson submitted to public pressure and, following the recommendations of the Kerner Report, signed new housing legislation into law.
Word came from Capitol Hill that Congress had passed and sent to the White House the Civil Rights Act of 1968. Included in the measure was a landmark open housing bill, which, when fully effective, would forbid discrimination in approximately 80% of all housing offered for rent or for sale in the United States.
Now, with this bill, the voice of justice speaks again. It proclaims that fair housing for all human beings who live in this country is now a part of the American way of life. We all know that the roots of injustice run deep, but violence cannot redress a solitary wrong or remedy a single unfairness. And we just must put our shoulders together and put a stop to both. The time is here. Action must be now.
The Fair Housing Act deemed it illegal for private individuals to discriminate on the basis of race in the sale or rental of housing. Even though the legislation explicitly deemed discriminatory housing transactions illegal, it lacked adequate enforcement mechanisms and put the onus on victims to file a formal complaint with HUD or sue in federal court to vindicate their rights. Alongside the Fair Housing Act's attempt to deal with discrimination, 1968 also saw the passage of a separate Housing and Urban Development Act, which aimed at improving the material conditions in public properties. This legislation was an unprecedented attempt to construct or rehabilitate America's public housing stock. 26 million units were to be built over a 10-year period, 6 million of which would be set aside for low and moderate income families.
Despite its breadth, none of Johnson's 1968 legislation succeeded in addressing the deep, systemic biases at the root of America's housing market. To prevent an already sizable budget deficit from expanding, the Democratic administration sought to partner with the real estate and banking industries to shift the production of low-income housing to the private sector. In an interview with Democracy Now!, Kianga Yamada Taylor, author of the book Race for Profit: How Banks and the Real Estate Industry Undermined Black Home Ownership, explains how this nexus of for-profit corporate housing providers was and is incompatible with improving and expanding affordable housing stock.
I think that there's a more fundamental problem that I definitely locate in my research, which is that there are two really opposing set of objectives here, where you have private real estate corporations and banks that are primarily interested in making money. Why is there no real affordable housing in the United States? Why is this a perennial problem that has never been solved? Because there's no money in creating affordable housing for poor and working class people. There's no money to be made. So when that is left to the private sector to fulfill, you know, it always comes up short because there's no money to be made in housing those kinds of people. So you have the profit motive from the private sector, but then, you know, what is the public policy for? It's to promote public welfare. And so these are two opposing goals, profiteering and public welfare. And to put them together erupts into, you know, a million different kinds of contradictions that play themselves out in these programs.
Whilst in theory this privatization was intended to remove the human bias from institutional housing policy, in reality, it only outsourced the racial discrimination of prior decades to the market, resulting in further enclosure, segregation, and gentrification. As Taylor puts it in an interview with The Nation, black people had to pay higher interest rates, they had to pay more fees, they were relegated to isolated and neglected housing. Black people's housing wasn't even an asset, it was a debt burden. This process was legitimized and empowered by the mortgage guarantees and subsidies of the federal government. A clear example can be found in Section 235 of the 1968 HUD Act. This program allowed people to pay $200 as a down payment on a house. The mortgage rate was set at 20% of their income, and the interest rate was capped at 1%. The federal government insured all mortgages purchased under these Section 235 terms. By insuring these mortgages, promising to pay off debts if the purchaser went into foreclosure, the government effectively incentivized short-term speculators and entrepreneurs into a newly cracked housing market. Profiteers bought cheap properties, and after inadequate superficial refurbishments, flipped them to poor families for easy profits. Because losses were publicly insured, desperate communities were targeted, in particular black women, in anticipation that they might default. The hope of a colorblind private sector distributing the sale of affordable housing therefore gave way to the reality of a government-endorsed system of market discrimination, a home for property speculators to rip off unsupported communities. As well as validating this predation, the government also lost the ability to regulate these new private housing developments, which meant it could not step in to correct these disparities without buying up huge swaths of housing stock. In the words of Taylor, racist exclusion gave way to predatory inclusion.
I describe the inclusion of African Americans into conventional real estate practices and mortgage banking as predatory. And it's really a way to understand how the previous period impacts the contemporary moment, meaning that the decades of disinvestment, of racist exclusion of African Americans from the conventional real estate market create a tremendous amount of distress in black communities. It is at the root of substandard housing in black communities. And those become the basis upon which, even when African Americans are included, for them to be treated differently, for them to be seen as more risky. And the whole notion of risk gives the banks and real estate industry an excuse to charge African Americans more, to subject them to less secure banking methods, all of which end up putting African Americans in making them vulnerable to new predatory practices.
In January 1969, Richard Nixon succeeded Johnson as the incumbent of the White House. Playing to his electoral coalition of disaffected white suburban homeowners, Nixon invoked a law and order backlash against the civil rights movement, which promised to quell the race riots that had marked the closing years of the decade.
Because, my friends, let this message come through clear from what I say tonight. Time is running out for the merchants of crime and corruption in American society. The wave of crime is not going to be the wave of the future in the United States of America. We shall reestablish freedom from fear in America so that America can take the lead in reestablishing freedom from fear in the world. And to those who say that law and order is the code word for racism, there and here is a reply. Our goal is justice, justice for every American. If we are to have respect for law in America, we must have laws that deserve respect.
Nixon won the election by promising an alternative path to that of Hubert Humphrey and the Democratic Party. An end to the promise of government spending and to the expanding welfare state. It is time, Nixon said, accepting his nomination at the 1968 Republican National Convention, to quit pouring billions of dollars into programs that have failed in the United States of America. In line with this new brand of fiscal austerity, Nixon's administration placed a moratorium on all subsidized housing programs in 1973. This included the suspension of the 1937 Act, under which the federal government paid all the development costs and subsidized rents and deficits run by local housing authorities. In the 4 years following the passage of Johnson's 68 Act, subsidy programs had accounted for the initial development of around 1.5 million housing units. These now ground to a halt. In New York, Andrew Kerr, the city's housing development administrator, called the freeze a massive breach of faith on behalf of the federal government. On February 2nd, 1973, Nixon appointed Ohio lawyer James Lynn to the post of HUD secretary. Lynn, working with Republicans in Congress, helped to fashion a new Housing and Community Development Act. This act included $11.9 billion of funding over 3 years in the form of community development block grants to local governments, designed to devolve federal control over housing programs back to cities and states.
Mr. Nixon's new housing proposals will provide an additional $10.3 billion in mortgage money for FHA, VA, conventional, and thrift institution loans. It also provides for mobile home insurance. Following their meeting, Secretary Lynn told reporters how the proposals would spur the ailing housing industry.
One of the problems that a builder faces today is where the cash assistance is going, not cash assistance, where the financing is going to come from for the purchaser to buy from the builder. What this program does is tell the builder that there are assured sources of funds for that takeout, for the ultimate sale to his buyer. And I think that's the most important thing that it does. Now, beyond that, it also injects further funds into the savings and loan associations, the thrift institutions, I should say, generally, so as to offset some of the loss of funds that they've had recently through disintermediation.
Secretary Lynn seemed miffed when asked if he had read the Watergate transcripts. He said only partially and recommended that anyone who did read them should do so at least three times for full understanding.
Just 12 days after Nixon's farewell speech following the scandal at Watergate, the new president, Gerald Ford, signed the 1974 Act into law. This landmark piece of legislation amended the previous 1937 Act to create what is known today as Section 8 housing. Under Section 8, HUD administers vouchers as open-ended subsidies to private home providers as an alternative to building public housing projects. By targeting these subsidies at those who provide shelter to extremely low-income households, Section 8 intended to make unaffordable market rate housing accessible to those otherwise excluded by extortionate rent prices. In this way, successive US governments slowly phased out public investment on housing construction, replacing it with a system of subsidies and market nudges.
With the stagflation crisis of the mid to late 1970s and the failure of Keynesian spending plans to reinvigorate the economy, this small government logic worked its way to the forefront of all policy issues in the guise of neoliberal economics. In 1981, Ronald Reagan was elected on a mandate to slash federal spending across all sectors, with the exception of the military.
Waste and fraud are serious problems. Back in 1980, federal investigators testified before one of your committees that corruption has permeated virtually every area of the Medicare and Medicaid healthcare industry. One official said many of the people who were cheating the system were very confident that nothing was going to happen to them. Well, something is going to happen. Not only the taxpayers are defrauded, the people with real dependency on these programs are deprived of what they need because available resources are going not to the needy, but to the greedy. The time has come to control the uncontrollable. In August, we made a start. I signed a bill to reduce the growth of these programs by $44 billion over the next 3 years, while at the same time preserving essential services for the truly needy.
Making a distinction between what he called real dependency and those defrauding the federal government, Reagan promised to streamline spending, cutting $40 billion from the budget, with $16 billion coming directly from programs that primarily aided the poor. Alongside Medicaid, food stamps, and unemployment relief, the Reagan administration made vast cuts to housing aid. Following the advice of his newly appointed housing task force, dominated by developers, landlords, and bankers, Reagan halved the budget for public housing during his first year in office, cutting Section 8 spending to about $17.5 billion. In 1970, there were 300,000 more low-cost rental units than low-income renter households. By 1985, the number of low-cost units had fallen to 5.6 million, and the number of low-income renter households had grown to 8.9 million. By the late 1980s, 600,000 Americans were sleeping on the streets on any given night. Elected on a mandate to streamline public finances and root out corruption, Reagan's time in office was marked by a tide of deregulation, which resulted in just the opposite. the 1980s saw pervasive racial discrimination by banks, real estate agents, and landlords, as well as an orgy of commercial property speculation. In 1986, Reagan's Tax Reform Act proposed a new supply-side solution to the rent affordability crisis. The low-income housing tax credit system introduced subsidies to private developers to incentivize the production of housing units for low-income tenants. In the years after Reagan had left office, it was discovered that his HUD secretary Samuel Pierce and his associates had been rigging the distribution system for tax credits in favor of Republican benefactors and lobbyists. Although 16 convictions were eventually handed out, Secretary Pierce was not charged. By the end of Reagan's term in office, federal assistance to local governments had been cut by nearly 60%.
The next meaningful piece of housing legislation came in 1992, when Congress authorized the HOPE 6 program. HOPE 6 sought to replace what it designated as severely distressed public housing with mixed income developments through federal grants. Whilst the program cleared swathes of existing public housing stock, it did not replenish the supply of affordable housing for tenants that lost their residences. Only a third of displaced renters received voucher assistance for the newly refurbished mixed income properties. Instead, HOPE 6 has been used as a loophole by private developers to demolish tens of thousands of public housing units that were not initially categorized as severely distressed. During the period from 1991 to 1999, affordable units to renters with very low incomes fell by 1.3 million, while the units affordable to extremely low income renters fell by 940,000 during the same period.
Our next step in the fight against crime is to take on gangs the way we once took on the mob. I'm directing the FBI and other investigative agencies to target gangs that involve juveniles in violent crime and to seek authority to prosecute as adults teenagers who maim and kill like adults. And I challenge local housing authorities and tenant associations. Criminal gang members and drug dealers are destroying the lives of decent tenants. From now on, the rule for residents who commit crime and peddle drugs should be one strike and you're out.
In 1996, President Bill Clinton introduced his one strike and you're out rule as part of a war on crime initiative, declaring that anyone committing a violent or drug-related crime in public housing would face eviction. Clinton's HUD enforced this order by grading housing authorities on their compliance with the new rule. Those with a low score would be less likely to receive federal funds. This coupled the systematic disinvestment in public housing seen under previous administrations with new discriminatory regulations, making it increasingly difficult for low-income, often minority people, to access affordable housing. In the final year of his second term in office, Clinton signed into law an ultimate legal cap on the number of public housing units that can exist at any one time. The infamous Faircloth Amendment essentially halted the construction of new public housing by setting limits on the number of units owned by local associations. Since the Faircloth Amendment was signed, the US has lost up to 15,000 housing units annually due to disrepair. With public housing stocks dwindling, and their occupants being increasingly stigmatized, the private sector entered the new millennium as the only agent developing in America's increasingly precarious housing market.
In the wake of the 2003 tech crash, private investors turned to mortgages as a secure source of revenue, with ever-increasing property prices as virtually guaranteed collateral. Mortgage lending and home buying kicked in overdrive, and investors increasingly sought to maximize returns on ever more risky contracts. In 2007, the housing bubble, created by the lending of impossibly insured subprime mortgages, blew up. Millions of Americans defaulted on their payments. With America's largest banks on the brink of collapse and millions of homeowners facing foreclosure, Congress passed the Emergency Economic Stabilization Act, which was, at that time, the largest bailout ever instigated by the federal government. The Troubled Asset Relief Program, also known as TARP, saw the government purchase the assets and equity in a number of failing financial institutions.
By coming together on this legislation, we have acted boldly to help prevent the crisis on Wall Street from becoming a crisis in communities across our country. We have shown the world that the United States of America will stabilize our financial markets and maintain a leading role in the global economy. A major problem in our financial system is that banks have restricted the flow of credit to businesses and consumers. Many of the assets these banks are holding have lost value. The legislation Congress passed today addresses this problem head on by providing a variety of new tools to the government, such as allowing us to purchase some of the troubled assets and creating a new government insurance program that will guarantee the value of others.
TARP infused $250 billion into the banking system to facilitate lending. With the giant investment bank Bear Stearns on the brink of collapse, the Federal Reserve Bank of New York curated a rescue package with $29 billion lent to JPMorgan Chase to buy the firm. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, two massive mortgage lenders, were also rescued from insolvency when the U.S. government committed $200 billion to bail them out. In September 2008, the U.S. government also bailed out AIG, one of the world's largest insurance companies, to the tune of $180 billion, taking 79.9% equity in the company. As the federal government spent upwards of $700 billion bailing out the banks and insurance giants most responsible for the crisis, millions of homeowners were left to face eviction or foreclosure. In 2008, 3 million units were foreclosed, one in every 54 households.
President Obama unveiled the plan in Arizona, which has been hit hard by the housing crisis. He said millions of American homeowners need immediate help to avoid foreclosure on their homes.
So I just want to make this clear. This plan will not save every home, but it will give millions of families resigned to financial ruin a chance to rebuild. It will prevent the worst consequences of this crisis from wreaking even greater havoc on the economy. And by bringing down the foreclosure rate, it will help to shore up housing prices for everybody.
The president said 6 million Americans are currently in foreclosure or at risk of losing their homes. His plan aims to help borrowers who owe more on the mortgages than their homes are worth and those on the verge of foreclosure by getting lenders to restructure or refinance the loans.
Faced with an immediate foreclosure crisis, President Obama instituted the Home Affordable Modification Program in 2009. Rather than providing support directly to borrowers, HAMP gave federal money to mortgage servicing companies to encourage them to modify the loans. With aid arbitrarily doled out by banks, public funds were constrained to the whims of private interests. By 2016, less than 1 million people actually received sustained assistance, while over 6 million households had been foreclosed. With America's public housing stock also in a state of disrepair from decades of disinvestment, Obama instituted a new rental policy, the Rental Assistance Demonstration, RAD, in 2012. Like previous administrations, Obama's RAD program outsourced responsibility for affordable lets to the private sector, allowing local authorities to transfer public housing over to private ownership on the condition that they be subsidized by Section 8 vouchers. This increased pressure on an already oversaturated and unaffordable private housing market, and new applicants joined Section 8 waiting lists so long that nearly half of them were struck off. While Wall Street firms were bailed out, those struggling with affordable housing at the bottom were left to face the full force of the Great Recession.
Does President Trump like HUD, or is that one of the agencies that's ripe for streamlining and turning into a more private sector type organization? How do you fare in the budget recently? Are there cuts, aren't there? Or?
Well, there were some cuts that had to be made pretty much across the board.
because we do have to recognize that there is such a thing as fiscal responsibility, which people for years and years have talked about, but no one has practiced. Now we're actually practicing it. But at the same time, I must say, we brought in a COO, because you need an operator. I learned that in my many years on the board of Kellogg and Costco. You can sit around the table and talk about things all day long, but unless you have an operator, nothing's going to get done. We have that. We're actively searching for a CFO, somebody who really understands the financial world and organization. We're bringing on a CIO so that we can take a holistic view of some of the problems. I'm sure you're aware of some of the material weaknesses that have been found in HUD's organization over the years. You know, I'm not satisfied just to sit back and say, oh, well, that's just the government. We're going to change it into a business-oriented, logical organization. You're going to get a lot more done. We're already seeing tremendous savings in some areas. It can be done, no question about it. And as far as, you know, whatever money we have, if it's $10 or if it's $10 trillion, we're going to use it efficiently and effectively. That's going to be the difference.
Following the election of Donald Trump and his administration's explicit agenda to hollow out regulatory executive departments, Ben Carson, a former neurosurgeon with no political nor housing policy experience, was tasked with heading HUD. In eroding the administrative state, Carson's main task has been to cut HUD spending. Trump's 2020 federal budget aimed at eliminating the Community Development Block Grant Program, and whilst unsuccessful, the administration has reproposed its removal in 2021.
Facing the worst COVID outbreak in the world, the U.S. Congress passed the Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security Act in March of this year. As part of the largest stimulus package in American history, the $2 trillion CARES Act instituted a 120-day moratorium on all evictions in federally assisted housing. With over 4 million confirmed coronavirus cases, the expiration of this moratorium at the end of the month foreshadows a tsunami of evictions. While the 2008 recession displaced 10 million people from their homes, the current downturn could be far worse. With emergency aid expiring and Congress stalling over a new relief package, some experts believe that between 20 million and 28 million people could face eviction between now and September. But Trump's negligence does not represent a departure from decades of federal housing policy. Whether it be the discriminatory redlining practices of the New Deal or the turn towards marketization in the neoliberal era, federal policy has produced a housing system ripe with inequality and precarity. Since Nixon's moratorium in 1973, successive administrations with bipartisan congressional support have taken an axe to public housing, producing skyrocketing homelessness rates, and for those who do have homes, unaffordable rents. In the second part of our documentary on US housing, we'll take a look at the growing movement of people pushing a radical new set of policies in the face of the current eviction crisis, and consider how popular social movements are reshaping the political discourse on housing in the context of the 2020 US elections.
Thank you for listening to this Our Voices podcast from Open Democracy. If you enjoyed this podcast and would encourage others to listen, head to iTunes, subscribe, and leave us a review. Open Democracy is an independent global media platform that is only possible because of your kind donations. To find out more or to make a donation, head to opendemocracy.net.